Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the massive fire at Chevron's refinery in Richmond, California. The fire sent smoke billowing into the dark sky. Thousands of East Bay residents were ordered to stay in their homes with their windows and doors closed. 15,000 people were hospitalized for respiratory issues. All employees were accounted for, and luckily there were no fatalities. On Friday, the city of Richmond filed a lawsuit against Chevron, accusing the multinational of, quote, willful and conscious disregard for public safety, end quote. The suit alleges that the explosion resulted from years of neglect, lax oversight, and corporate indifference to necessary safety inspection and repairs. The suit also alleges that while Chevron ignored safety warnings, the company paid $52.8 million to its top three executives in 2011 alone. According to CBS, the lawsuit seeks financial compensation for economic damage to the city, including the costs of emergency response, firefighting, environmental cleanup, and loss of value in city property. On Saturday, 3,000 people from around the Bay Area marched from the Richmond BART station to the gates of Chevron to raise awareness about the fire, Chevron's business practices, and alternative energy. More than 200 demonstrators were arrested, including three people in wheelchairs, a 90-year-old woman, and an 18-year-old. The protest was part of the Summer Heat Campaign, organized by 350.org, which is mobilizing nationwide campaigns against the Keystone XL pipeline. One significant aspect of the mobilization on Saturday was the presence of a broad coalition of environmental organizations, unions, social justice groups, urban gardeners, and many others. So on today's Your Call, we are going to take a look at how local groups are responding to the global climate crisis, what's the coalition that can move us away from fossil fuels, and how are local groups taking on a multi-billion dollar corporation like Chevron. Today we're joined by Andres Soto. He's a Richmond organizer for Communities for a Better Environment. That's an environmental justice group that has previously sued Chevron over what it says was a shoddy environmental impact report. And Andres joins us from Richmond. Hi, Andres. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Brooke Anderson. She's a longtime union and workers' rights organizer in the Bay Area. She's currently working with 350.org. She organized the labor contingent. 30 labor unions were involved in Saturday's action. And Brooke joins us from Oakland. Hi, Brooke. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
And we're joined by Marissa Zuckerman. She's a summer fellow at 350.org, and she was arrested on Saturday. Hi, Marissa. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Brooke, let's start off with you. What went into bringing so many different groups together? I understand that this was actually quite an accomplishment for 350.org.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really exciting to see labor unions and worker centers and worker cooperatives jump so fully into the fight for climate justice. So this past Saturday, we had over 30 different labor unions and worker justice organizations sponsoring the action. So everybody from, you know, unions like AFSCME 57 and 3299 to, you know, SEIU to the hotel workers, Unite Here 2850, and the nurses. So you just saw hundreds of rank and file workers who, you know, are gardeners and housekeepers and longshoremen and teachers and nurses out there in the streets sort of bringing who they are both in their workplaces as well as in their neighborhoods to the march, and, you know, many of them, myself included, were also arrested in that action.
What went on behind the scenes? I mean, when you're all talking about trying to get different groups involved, what was it about this action that brought all of these groups together? Brooke?
So from the labor perspective, you know, part of what we did for 2 months in the lead up to the action is go union by union, and we did presentations to unions about what's happening with the climate crisis, but then specifically talking to workers about what the environmental health impacts are that they're facing on the job. So a lot of workers are, you know, facing toxic chemicals on the job. Many of these same workers live in Richmond and have been subject to decades of pollution and have family members who experienced the fire. So that was part of the organizing that we did in the lead up to the action.
And Andres, you know, for those of us who live in other parts of Northern California, it's easy to forget that Chevron, such a massive multinational, is in our backyard. And I'm wondering, what is the conversation like in Richmond when it comes to Chevron and last year's explosion?
Well, the conversation obviously began with the anger at the explosion. People have such a long history and experience with dealing with the explosions and the fires at the refinery that, you know, they knew that they had to report to the hospital. And as you mentioned, you know, 15,000 people plus reported to the hospital. But folks here in Richmond in a variety of sectors have been working on how to deal with Chevron and make it more accountable to the local community, to improve its safety record, to improve its, to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, and to stop polluting our politics for a number of years. CBE, as an organization, has been involved in Richmond for 30 years, along with the West County Toxics Coalition, and in the last decade, the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. So there's a core group of folks who have been working on environmental justice issues for quite some time now. But 10 years ago, we created an organization that united progressive Democrats and Greens and Independents called the Richmond Progressive Alliance, and slowly started building up a political base for progressive politics that we knew existed. But here in Richmond, which has the highest per capita Democratic Party registration of any city in the Bay Area, all the politics were dominated by Republican or corporate type of interests, whether it was Chevron, the Chamber of Commerce, the Council of Industries, and their surrogates, such as the Richmond Police Officers Association and Firefighters Association, in the political actions that kept our city government from holding Chevron accountable. And over the past 10 years, in each election, we've run candidates, ultimately getting Gail McLaughlin elected mayor and Jovanka Beckles and Jeff Ritterman and others. And what we saw in the last couple of elections was a major pushback by Chevron, where, you know, they've spent over $1 million in each of the last two elections to try to defeat our candidates. And it's raised the ante on the struggle on politics. But this event that occurred on Saturday, where folks from around the region came to express their anger at Chevron's behavior and its role in the whole, you know, global climate crisis, has really invigorated us here locally. We knew the lawsuit was something that was coming down. You know, we had to advocate and push for that because, frankly, some council members were afraid to offend Chevron because they're afraid of getting attacked by Chevron. And, of course, they
but do have a couple of tactics
on the council.
Council members did unanimously vote to sue, right?
Well, yeah, after delaying the hiring of the law firm while they tried to give Chevron an extra 30 days to negotiate in good faith, and once again they got burned. And then plus, with this being such a major event, a major lawsuit, even Chevron's candidates were given a pass by Chevron to vote unanimously against this because the political backlash against them would have been so great. So this is, you know, like a chess game. So even Chevron's candidates voted for the lawsuit, and, you know, with Chevron's approval. That way, you know, they can make them look like they're more moderate rather than the right-wing nuts they are.
Again, on Friday, the city of Richmond filed a lawsuit against Chevron, accusing the multinational of, quote, willful and conscious disregard for public safety. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the massive fire at the refinery in Richmond, California. Marissa, you're a summer fellow at 350.org, and you were arrested at the action on Saturday. Talk about how you got involved in this movement.
Yeah, so I am a sophomore at Pitzer College, and I first got involved with this movement through the divestment campaign, which is happening at colleges and universities, as well as cities and religious organizations across the country. And then I applied to be a summer fellow with 350 this summer, and I've been working in the Oakland office. And Summer Heat has been such an incredible campaign that's been happening across the summer at locations all across the country. And this one in Richmond was such an incredible event. I grew up in Oakland and remember, of course, the fire last year, and it was so great to be able to offer support and participate in such an incredible event that really brought a lot of people together.
And to talk about your arrest, what happened? Over 200 people were arrested. What was the action involved? Why did you get arrested?
Yes, that's right. So the action was essentially a mass trespass onto the Chevron Refinery's property. As you said, there were 210 people that got arrested on Saturday, and we gathered at the rally and marched onto the Chevron Refinery through their gate and sat down in front of a line of police and just basically, you know, said the message that we are here because Chevron is doing something wrong and being a bad neighbor to the community of Richmond and to communities across the world, and it needs to stop.
Brooke Anderson, I noticed in a lot of the articles about this, the arrests were near the very top. You're a longtime union and workers' rights organizer. How do you feel about this these days? Do you feel like there has to be massive arrests in order for something like this to get widespread media attention?
Yeah, I think there has to be massive resistance, right? And so one part of that is civil disobedience when and where necessary. And I think, you know, coming out of the labor movement, a lot of folks are looking at this as, you know, the folks who have contributed most to the problem, right? The 1% are the ones who are still trying to figure out how to profit off of a changing environment and a changing climate. And so, you know, a lot of the same industries and interests that have been fighting the worker rights movement, so for instance, like the Koch brothers, are behind the Keystone XL pipeline, and workers aren't going to stand for that. So we know that this kind of transition is inevitable, and the question is whether or not that transition in a changing climate is going to happen justly or not. And part of making sure that there's justice in this transition is building a really big tent, is building a big coalition, and labor's excited to be part of that. And, you know, it was interesting to talk to workers about whether or not they'd be willing to get arrested for this. And for many folks, it was a no-brainer. They, you know, folks put out that they have kids who have asthma and they have relatives who had ended up in the hospital regarding, you know, following the Chevron fire. And so for many people, this was absolutely the right thing to do this past Saturday, including rank-and-file workers. We even had, for instance, a union gardener from the union AFSCME 3299 that represents workers at the UC Berkeley system who worked with us to plant sunflower starts on Chevron's property. Sunflowers are bioremediators. They actually pull the toxins out of the soil. And so it was a symbolic but also a very practical action to say we're reclaiming Chevron's land for the community and detoxifying both Chevron and our community. So it was exciting to see him arrested. We also had a president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union Local 6 get arrested. And so it's exciting to see elected presidents of unions stepping up and bringing their workers with them to take on these actions.
That is Brooke Anderson, a longtime union and workers' rights organizer in the Bay Area. She's currently working with 350.org, and she was in charge of the labor contingent. More than 30 labor unions were involved in Saturday's action at Chevron. 3,000 people marched from the Richmond BART station to Chevron to raise awareness about last year's massive refinery fire, which caused 15,000 people to go to the hospital for respiratory issues. They also wanted to raise awareness about Chevron's business practices and then bring awareness back to alternative energy. And so today we are talking about, you know, what is most successful when you're talking about alternative energy and removing the country from fossil fuels? And what about taking on a multi-billion dollar multinational like Chevron? If you were involved in the action, we'd love to hear from you. If you live in the East Bay and you'd like to talk about what you remember from last year and what does the conversation sound like now, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How can grassroots power take on a global crisis like the energy crisis? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Also, what do you think about the lawsuit that was filed by the city of Richmond? We're also joined today by Andre Soto. He's a Richmond organizer for Communities for a Better Environment, an environmental justice group that has previously sued Chevron over what it says was a shoddy environmental impact report. And Marissa Zuckerman is a summer fellow with 350.org, and she was arrested on Saturday. Andres, what about that larger question? I mean, how can local groups take on, you know, both a global crisis like climate change and also just a massive multinational like Chevron? Last year, their earnings were $26 billion, and then for the first quarter this year, it was about $5.3 billion. So we're talking about a massive corporation here.
Right. I think people have to be prepared to work both the inside game and the outside game. So on the inside game, it's understanding the regulatory environment that these corporations have to operate within and really make them function better on behalf of the people, because for the most part, they are public agencies. So, for example, here in the Bay Area, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, which is ultimately a surrogate for the federal EPA, is in the process of developing a rule that will limit emissions from industrial facilities. And our strategy is to get them to adopt for the first time ever in the nation a limit on the quality of the crude, you know, limiting the sulfur content of the crude oil that is processed in the refineries. And, of course, industry is opposed to it. So we have to mobilize, and we are engaged and have been making comments to the Air District about this, and this process is a year-long process, so there's still plenty of time for people to get involved with that. At the same time, we saw Cal OSHA came in and made all these citations for willful violations, and yet they're, because of the influence of the petrochemical industry in Sacramento, the fines totaled less than what Chevron spent in our local city council elections. So that's no disincentive. We got to make real penalties that hurt them in the only place they care about, which is their profits. And utilizing agencies like the Chemical Safety Board, who felt this explosion was so serious that they had to come into Richmond and do the investigation that they did, that has really shined a light on the fact that this was an issue of management practice of running refineries into the ground, as opposed to their PR spin, which is, oh, you know, safety is a core value. So that's part of the inside game. The outside game is what we just did this past weekend, which is creating a very broad coalition uniting a whole range of people who are seriously concerned about this, mobilizing them and bringing light to the issues by this direct action, people getting arrested, which brings media attention, and starting that dialogue so that people who may be not aware of it, or people who are sitting on the fence and thinking about getting involved, will understand now there's a vehicle for them to participate in, because it's really going to take a broad mass number of people to force these corporations to change, both from the outside and the inside.
And Brooke, same question to you as a longtime organizer. What is the most effective way, first off, to take on such a massive crisis like climate change?
Well, I think one of the things that is important to say is that the scale of the crisis, right, that it's a global climate crisis and ecological crisis, does not necessarily dictate the same scale of the solutions, right? So I think sometimes folks hear the global climate crisis and feel like the solution is going to come from, you know, global protocols at the climate convenings, or that there's going to be federal legislation on climate. And it's not that those are necessarily bad spaces places to work in, but I think where we are most effective is where we have the most power, which is on the local level. So, you know, reflecting on Andres's comments, just the incredible work that he and the Communities for a Better Environment and Asian Pacific Environmental Network have done in really flipping the politics in Richmond is a great example of the local work that can happen. I also think that, you know, folks are looking at local solutions, everything from looking at folks who are doing urban gardening, right? So up in Richmond, the folks at Urban Tilth and a lot of urban gardens here in Oakland, people who are fighting the privatization of water by putting rain catchment systems up on their roofs, folks who are fighting to widen the public transportation systems and make them more accessible. Same thing with fighting for zero waste in our cities. But all of those solutions, from a labor perspective, also have to come with justice for workers, right? And so, you know, just a timely comment on the BART strike, right? So those workers, those BART workers are really climate workers. They're fighting to, you know, keep greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere with every trip that BART makes across the bay every day, and those workers deserve justice. Same with recycling workers. While we fight for a zero-waste system in Alameda County, we have recycling workers who are being paid, you know, $10 an hour and struggling to put food on their families and pay the bills and make the, you know, the tough choices about whether they pay rent or health care, and that's unacceptable. So the workers who are really frontline climate workers, we have to fight for justice for them. But I think those fights around the sort of democratization of labor and having an economy that really puts people and planet before pollution and profit is part of that fight. And I think what's exciting about that is that it means everybody can participate, right? It doesn't mean that you have to have been to, you know, some of the global forums on climate. It doesn't mean that you have to be in Washington, D.C. lobbying, although those things are certainly important. It means that there's something that you can do in your workplace to organize your coworkers to fight for climate justice and in your neighborhood to prepare the folks that you live in community with to better weather this transition by being self-sufficient on our food and on our water and our transportation systems.
Well, let's take a few callers before we go to break. Let's hear from Reverend Earl in Richmond, who was part of the protest. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to point out that the 350 Bay Area, which is a local, we're not quite a branch of 350, but we and the Keystone XL pipeline played key roles in organizing this event. And one part of 350 Bay Area is Chevron Watch, which is now a partner with RPA and CPEN and all the other organizations in addressing the issues with Chevron. The creation of solidarity at the local level, at the city and the regional level, I think are critical, especially in this time of the logjam in D.C.
And can I ask you, what are your thoughts on the most effective way to take on something like climate change in a multinational like Chevron?
Whew. Well, I started doing this work around climate change and then moved to environmental justice. And these days, I'm increasingly looking at questions of economic and political injustice, because I do not think that we are going to effectively address the issues we have in our culture unless we rebalance political and economic power.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. And today we are talking about climate change and Chevron. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the massive fire at the refinery in Richmond, California. You might remember that the dark sky was just full of smoke, and thousands of residents in the East Bay were told to stay in their homes, shut your windows, shut your doors, don't go outside. 15,000 people were hospitalized for respiratory issues. All the employees were accounted for. Luckily, there were no fatalities. And on Friday, the city of Richmond filed a lawsuit against Chevron, accusing the multinational of willful and conscious disregard for public safety. The lawsuit alleges that while Chevron ignored safety warnings, the company paid $52.8 million to its top three executives in 2011 alone. So there was an action on Saturday. 3,000 people marched from the Richmond BART station to Chevron to raise awareness about the fire and to bring attention to alternative energy. So when we're talking about these kinds of actions, what makes it most effective? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW. To take part in today's conversation, you can call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller, because we always like to hear new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about National Night Out. These are when neighborhoods have block parties to raise awareness about keeping the neighborhood safe and to also connect with local police. And a lot of people say, I like the idea of this, but I'm also a little bit skeptical, especially if I feel targeted already by neighborhood watch programs rather than be protected by them. So what are your thoughts on these watch programs? When do they build connections between neighbors, and when do they breed suspicion? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the most effective ways to take on major issues like climate change and also multinational corporations like Chevron. On Saturday, 3,000 people marched from the Richmond BART station to Chevron to raise awareness about last year's fire, to raise awareness about Chevron's business practices and alternative energy. More than 200 people were arrested, including three people in wheelchairs, a 90-year-old and an 18-year-old. And if you were part of the action, we'd love to hear from you. If you live in the East Bay and you have some thoughts about the fire, what do you remember about it? And what does the conversation sound like today? I mean, what changes do you want Chevron to make? Again, this is a company that posted $26 billion in earnings last year. For the first quarter this year, $5.4 billion. So when you're talking about taking on a multinational, what does that mean exactly? What changes do you want to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Andre Soto, a Richmond organizer for Communities for a Better Environment, an environmental justice group that has previously sued Chevron. Brooke Anderson is a longtime union and workers' rights organizer. She's working with 350.org. She organized the labor contingent. 30 labor unions took part on Saturday. Marissa Zuckerman is a summer fellow at 350.org. She's a sophomore in college, and she was arrested on Saturday. We have an email from Denise who says, my concern is that we, the taxpayers who pay for police protection, wind up being arrested while Chevron avoids paying taxes and has police protection. So we just looked up some information, and according to Think Progress, Chevron paid 19% in taxes last year, half of the top corporate tax rate of 35%, and they received an estimated $700 million in annual tax breaks last year. Brooke, when you bring up these facts, does this kind of stuff resonate with people, with the public? Does this get them out on the streets?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, yes, especially around April when we're all paying our taxes at a much higher tax rate than Chevron does. But, you know, I also think it's the memory of the fire, and it's the not being able to send your kids out to play and seeing your kid using a respirator, right? Like those are the things that really resonate with people. But, you know, I think from a labor perspective, one of the things that many workers find troubling is, you know, we hear this like, oh, especially from Chevron, especially from the fossil fuel industry, but we provide jobs, right? We provide jobs, and therefore we are not supposed to critique the way in which they are polluting communities. And I think one of the things when we talk about the tax breaks and we talk about the subsidies to the fossil fuel industry that we have to talk about is, you know, when you give $1 million to the fossil fuel industry in government subsidies, which is really our tax dollars, right, that we've paid it at a higher level, they create 5 jobs, right? And that is very, very few jobs for $1 million, whereas the clean energy economy is able to create 16 jobs with the same amount of subsidies. And so we actually know that our taxpayer dollars that we're paying at a higher rate than Chevron is going back to the same companies that are creating very few jobs for our communities. And so I think part of what the goal of the labor contingent this past Saturday was is to actually say, no, it's not that we can have either jobs or a clean environment, but that we demand both. And we know that it's the fossil fuel industry that has cut 12,000 jobs in the last 3 years, and that they're not a job creator in our communities, and that we demand a just transition away from the dirty, sort of death-dependent fossil fuel industry and toward good jobs and a clean energy economy. And those jobs aren't just jobs putting up, you know, solar panels or whatnot. That doesn't constitute a good job. Those have to be jobs that are good environmental jobs, but also that pay well and that have benefits and that people can, you know, support and sustain their family and get respect on the job in the course of those green jobs. And so that's what we were demanding as a labor contingent on Saturday, is good union jobs for local residents in an industry, clean energy, that builds up our community as opposed to pollutes our communities.
And on that note, we have an email from Henry who says, I participated in the march and got arrested. It was a great action, and I'm grateful to Andres Brook and everyone else involved in putting it together. My one concern is that one of the key demands, stopping the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, is getting lost. It wasn't even mentioned in the Chronicle story, and I'm not hearing much about it here. It's great to focus on Chevron and its crimes, but let's not forget that we also have to stop the pipeline and prevent the extraction of the tar sands oil if we're to have any prayer of avoiding climate catastrophe. What about that, Andres? Was Keystone the topic of conversation on Saturday?
Well, it was one of many topics that were covered because this is it's like the Hydra, right? There's a multi-headed creature out here. And even if we stop the Keystone XL pipeline, as the person who wrote in was saying, the tar sands are up there, the North Dakota Bakken is out there, and for example in Benicia, they have a proposal to bring that stuff in by rail out here to the West Coast. They're not waiting for a pipeline. So it's more than just the Keystone XL pipeline. It's about extracting these dirtier, heavier crudes, because we're past peak oil. We're past the point where the light crudes, the so-called honey crudes, are available. At the Richmond refinery, 80% of the oil that's refined comes from the Persian Gulf by tankers across the Pacific Ocean through the Indian Ocean, which tells you why we had the war over there. So, you know, this is a global situation. It's more than just the pipeline, but the pipeline is a critical piece of infrastructure. And one of the things, like Brooke was saying, you know, the issue about jobs has really split the labor community and split, you know, the activist community and split groups like the Blue-Green Alliance, because the building trades unions collectively really have no social consciousness about the environment. They just want jobs. They're a hiring hall. They get their people out there on the jobs and on temporary jobs, whereas people like the steel workers and other folks who have to work permanently in these facilities are far more concerned about the safety and health implications related to processing these dirtier crudes than the folks who simply go in there and build up the infrastructure. So, you know, that's a gap that needs to really be bridged. And, you know, the building trades as a union group contribute more money than any other sector of labor in Sacramento. So, you know, that's one of the challenges that we're facing, is that the corporations use the divide and conquer strategies all around the world and around the country and labor and within communities. And so these are challenges we have to overcome.
We have full line, so I want to be sure to get to calls. Brooke, you're a longtime union organizer. Is that a fair assessment of what's going on here?
Yeah, Andres is absolutely right, is that, you know, for a long time we've seen the labor community divided on this question of jobs, and I think the tide is starting to shift within labor, especially here locally and especially as was visible in last Saturday's march, is, you know, previously I think there was a sense in the labor movement that unless your job was at stake in a particular, in the building of a particular pipeline or a particular refinery, that you as a union or you as a worker had no voice or no right to speak up on that. And I think it's really exciting to see workers challenge that. So, for instance, you know, you saw the California Nurses Association say recently, look, we are the nurses who are the frontline workers whenever there's an environmental disaster, catastrophe, including having treated work, treated the community residents in Richmond. And we think that the pipeline and we think that these refineries are detrimental to our patients' health. And so part of what it means to be a union is to speak up and advocate for our patients. Similarly, you talk to union workers who say, well, why wouldn't my union take a stand on something that is hurting me and my children and my ability to live in my community and to be safe on the job? And so I think Andres has absolutely represented that well, and I think that the tide is starting to shift.
All right. Well, thank you for writing, Harry. And there's actually a good article over at Inside Climate News called Little Known Pipeline Nearly as Big as Keystone Could Win Race to Gulf. This isn't getting much attention at all. The Enbridge pipeline, converted from natural gas, would carry tar sands crude like Keystone, but is expected to easily win regulatory approval. This would carry crude oil from Illinois to Louisiana. And so we'll put a link. It's a 774-mile line, and we'll put a link to this article on our website right after the show. So thank you for the email, Harry, Henry. I'm sorry. You can email us feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about taking on a global crisis like climate change and a multinational like Chevron. As Henry said, he feels like Keystone's sort of getting lost in this discussion. It's part of it. But as you're hearing from Andres, Brooke, and Marissa, there are just so many elements to this. So when you've got an issue that's so massive, I mean, how do you make it tangible for people? And where do you put the focus? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What is most effective when you're talking about taking on such a global crisis? You can also leave a comment on our website, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Andres Soto is a Richmond organizer for Communities for a Better Environment. Brooke Anderson is a longtime organizer. She's currently working with 350.org. She organized the labor contingent on Saturday. 3,000 people, including 30 labor unions, marched from the Richmond BART station to Chevron to raise awareness about last year's explosion, Chevron's business practices, and alternative energy. Marissa Zuckerman is a summer fellow at 350.org. She was one of the 200 people who were arrested, including three in wheelchairs and a 90-year-old. And let's hear from Doria Robinson, who's the executive director of Urban Tilth. Hi, Doria. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So you were at the protest?
Oh, yes, yeah. Definitely. Definitely supporting.
And so can you talk a little bit about, I understand that a number of urban farmers and gardeners got involved.
Yeah. So, you know, last year's fire, the Chevron refinery, really had a pretty dramatic effect on a lot of folks who were trying to create a new food system in Richmond, you know, just really making it clear that deposition from the refinery is really a threat to our health. When you saw the fire kind of go overhead for hours and hours, you know, not knowing what was in that plume, it became clear that it was no longer, you know, we couldn't be quiet any longer. You know, we actually had to stand up and support people who were really leading this charge to get you know, corporations like Chevron to be responsible, and not just that, but just really move towards the just transition that we really need.
You know, and what does it mean when you say for a corporation to be responsible?
Well, you know, I don't think that a corporation has the right to threaten the health of 100,000 people in order to, you know, continue to increase their profits. I mean, you know, there are larger picture things, you know, that are kind of on the climate change scale, in terms of just transition that we need to deal with. And then there's also, you know, smaller frame, shorter term things that could be dealt with if these refineries were being more responsible. Chevron is the I think the worst of all the refineries in Contra Costa County in terms of health and environmental impacts. You know, there's some things that they could do. They could just take the pipes that are actually, you know, broken now that they're not fixing. They still have kind of these, you know, in just temporary fixes on them, and fix them properly to prevent another tragedy like August 6th last year. And I think that Communities for a Better Environment is kind of leading that charge. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit that they could do now, even in the current kind of petroleum, you know, paradigm, to actually ensure that Richmond residents and other people who are on the front lines around their, you know, operations are as guarded as they possibly can be, while we, you know, as a larger global community, push for the transition away from petrochemicals that we need.
All right. Well,
in terms of corporate responsibility, that's what I mean. They need to actually be responsible for the damage that they do, ongoing, chronic, and episodic to our health.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad we're bringing up this point. Doria Robinson, thanks for calling in. She's executive director of Urban Tilth. They cultivate agriculture in West Contra Costa County to focus on keeping communities more sustainable, healthy, and also fighting for a just food system. Marissa, I mean, you're a sophomore college student. When you talk about, you know, with your friends, for example, the changes you want to see from a company like Chevron, what really comes up for you? I mean, if you had a list of two things, what changes would you like to see?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's definitely the situation with young people and college students is changing rapidly. And when I talk to my friends about this, a lot of them are actually really interested and have begun to get involved. Just this past Saturday, actually, a friend of mine came with her mom and her little sister, and none of them had ever been to a protest or anything like that, but felt motivated and came out. And it's really wonderful to see how young people are really claiming this movement and joining in the fight. In terms of changing Chevron, you know, I think that it's hard to pick two things. This is a company that has, you know, a corporation that has showed such blatant disregard for, you know, and just negligence for the health and safety of the environment and communities across the country and the world. You know, in Ecuador, there's a huge situation going on there. And the situation in Richmond is really quite terrible. I don't know if there are two specific things that Chevron could do, certainly taking accountability for the damage that the fire did, and like Brooke and Andres have said, you know, paying their taxes and acting like a responsible member of the community would be a start. But a larger transition away from their destructive practices is really what's going to be necessary.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And thanks again for calling in. Let's hear next from Ray in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Another great show, as always. You always get the nail on the head with the right topics. And nobody's really mentioned much about renewable fuels yet. I have a biodiesel station in Santa Cruz, so we're, you know, going straight head-to-head with petroleum companies. Actually, our station is directly across from a Chevron station. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you can buy biodiesel in Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco, and there's a lot of ways to make ethanol that most cars today will run on. Whether you buy a new car that's a flex fuel car that runs on gas and or alcohol, you can even convert the old cars. And there's a whole bunch of ways you can make alcohol. There's a book called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which will even show you how to convert your car to run on alcohol, how to make it, how to build your own still, all kinds of things that we can be doing to directly go flying straight in the face of the petroleum peddlers who are out there destroying our world. And, you know, frankly, that's exactly what they're doing. And I just like to urge everybody to really check into this, because this is stuff that's available now. And not to mention the fact that you mentioned $700 million in tax revenue that was saved by Chevron. It's actually in the billions and billions and billions of dollars. There's a report out called, well, it's by Milton Coppolis, who is a former economic advisor to Ronald Reagan. So you know he's no bleeding heart liberal veggie burner. And he did a study that said, in 2006, if you consider all the military that keeps the Straits of Hormuz open, and he made a point of saying that it's not including war, this is just all the ship and the Marines and the Air Force and the everybody that keeps the straits flowing so oil can move in and out of the Middle East. Do you consider that and respiratory ailments that were directly linked to diesel exhaust that are covered by Medi-Cal, Medicaid, things like that?
Well,
and, direct links to, savings on real estate.
Ray, thank you.
Sorry, it's $11.
Thank you so much for calling, Ray. You know, I've actually been curious about the alcohol and water. So we'll look into that and see if we can maybe do a show on it. And I've never heard Bleeding Liberal Heart Veggie Burger. But thank you. I like that. Thank you so much for calling in. We actually have a related email about taxes. Linda writes, the neighborhood around the Chevron plant is horribly run down. Richmond is in a constant struggle to keep schools alive. How does Chevron avoid paying taxes? Can they be made to participate in the local welfare? Why not? She writes, no one has to buy gas at Chevron. Boycott them until it hurts. So again, earnings last year, $26 billion. First quarter this year, $5 billion. According to Think Progress, Chevron pays a 19% tax rate. Half of the top corporate tax rate is 35%, and they got about $700 million in annual tax breaks last year. Andres, this was actually a topic of conversation, and just quickly, because I definitely want to talk about renewables and alternative energy, but this was a topic of conversation last year. The Richmond City Council talked about just the lack of contribution to the community. Is there any update on that, and has Chevron taken any steps?
Well, there's this whole issue of taxation, and Richmond is one of those cities where in the post-Prop 13 era, it initiated the utility users tax. And it turned out once progressives got in there, found out the ordinance in Richmond allowed one ratepayer to set their own rate while everybody else had to pay the same rate, and that was Chevron. So there was negotiations and a settlement, and Chevron agreed to pay $115 million over the next 15 years in return for not getting sued about their utility user taxes. At the same time, they have been appealing all their property taxes from 2006 moving forward. And even had appealed others previously. And Chevron's property taxes account for roughly 25 to 30% of the city of Richmond's operating budget. So property taxes is a real issue when it comes to providing direct services. And
Andres, did we lose you? Well, we'll try to reconnect. Brooke, is there anything you want to add to that before we move on?
Not on the tax piece, but if I could respond just briefly to the question around the ethanol and stuff like that was raised by Ray. I think, on the alternative fuels, I think we need to be very cautious about not going down a road of false solutions. Mm-hmm. And so the question, I'm not suggesting he was saying this, but just in general, I think that we need to be very cautious to be clear that the question is not just how do we find something other than fossil fuels to fuel our airplanes and fuel our cars and essentially fuel a lifestyle that we have that essentially is not going to be fully sustained by the planet that we're on, right? And so we need to find ways for people to live closer to where they work, right? And to go to school closer to where they live. And we have to expand our public transportation systems and really find a way to live within the limits of our ecosystem and live within the limits of our food shed and our watershed. And that means restructuring our economy to put people before profits. Otherwise, I think you end up in a system where, even if we're not looking at fossil fuels, if we're looking at, plant-based fuels, all of a sudden then we're growing food, growing corn for cars and not for people. And that ends up causing, crop failures and massive food shortages for folks in other countries and increasingly in our own nation as well. So just, a caution around that there's not going to be some magic fix that's another type of fuel.
Right.
The real solution is changing our economy.
Right. And then also, what happened to the word conservation?
Right.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because obviously there's no silver bullet here, but you do have to at least make it tangible or explain it in such a way where people can visualize what a different society or a different economy looks like. So, I mean, how do you do that effectively to try to bring more people out to get them involved in this?
Well,
Andres, you're back. Hi.
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry about that. Yeah, well, you know, part of it is constantly beating the drum. There's always new information out there. As the climate crisis worsens, more and more people are going to be affected by it, and more people are going to come to the realization they need to do something about it. So in that sense, it's a combination of telling people the good news that, yeah, we can organize and work for change, both at state, local, federal levels, international level. But at the same time, you know, some people, they don't get motivated until it personally affects them or they feel that it's personally affecting them. So as we're going to see food prices go up, we're going to see water prices go up, gasoline prices go up, the wealth gap is going to increase. More and more people are going to get upset and going to get involved and build upon the work that others have been doing for many, many years. So we're all part of a continuum here of involvement. And, you know, it's kind of like what we've seen in a lot of social movements in the past. The thing that is really going to get massive number of people out into the street is more education. And then when things finally hit them personally and they feel they have a personal stake in this, as long as people can still go to the supermarket and get their food and go to the gas station and get their gas and fill up and take a vacation, most people don't really feel affected by it. Right now, it's mostly the poor and those who are in places like the refinery belt here in Contra Costa County, where we've suffered various forms of cancers and asthma and other autoimmune issues at disproportionate rates. That's what mobilizes us. We're already affected. And so now other people are finally coming around to it.
And we have a caller, Oliver, in Oakland. Sorry we can't take you, Oliver, because we're almost out of time. But Oliver says we can beat these challenges, but we need better, more entertaining public opinion campaigns. Brooke, just before we end, is it true that 350.org has had about 20,000 actions this year?
I'm not sure on the exact number. I'm sorry, Marissa, do you know that?
You know, I don't. I think that number may have been, might be total, but 350 has certainly stepped it up and helped to support and facilitate an incredible number of actions this past year and in previous years, and that will definitely continue.
Yeah, because the Keystone decision is coming down soon, right?
Yes, and that is going to be a really huge issue that will step up the game across the country. And, 40,000 people showed up in D.C. Wow. A few months ago, and that is another issue that affects indigenous communities and farmers and ranchers and small communities across the United States, and will certainly become quite an explosive issue if
right.
the president decides to approve it.
And there are protests happening in the middle of the country on a regular basis, and we will definitely continue to follow this. Marissa Zuckerman is a summer fellow at 350.org. She was arrested at Saturday's action. Brooke Anderson is currently working with 350.org, longtime union organizer. Andre Soto is a Richmond organizer for Communities for a Better Environment. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thanks for the great show.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the fire and the Richmond lawsuit and the action, along with some photos of the arrest. Thank you so much for sending those. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What do you think of neighborhood watch programs? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the National Night Out. Now that George Zimmerman has become the world's most famous neighborhood watchman, many people are questioning these programs, especially those who feel targeted rather than protected. When do these programs build connections between neighbors, and when do they breed suspicion? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.